Welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is James Jackson. One guest on this episode, but it is right on the news as the World Cup has become one of those events which has crossed over from just the sports public to the broader cultural public regarding whether you are in the United States or Mexico or Canada, quite frankly, anywhere in the world. Few better who cover that sport than Paul Tenorio. He is a senior writer for The Athletic. If you are a soccer fan, his byline is very familiar to you. In addition to The Athletic, The Washington Post and ESPN, Orlando Sentinel 442. He is in, I think he is somewhere in California right now covering this tournament, but he will tell us specifically. Paul, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on. Yeah, I'm in San Jose. We're on to the knockouts. I'm up in the Bay Area. The U.S. plays in Santa Clara next, so we've moved up. We've moved up the state from Southern California to Northern California.
All right, this is a media podcast, obviously. So I want to ask you some specific media questions to get into a little bit of covering this tournament. So first off, here's where I want to start. How has this tournament been as far as access for a reporter like yourself? You can be as broad in answering that as you wish.
Yeah, well, I think I'll come at it from the perspective that I can answer the best, which is from a U.S. national team perspective. They're very good at this stuff. When it comes to big tournaments, they are quite accessible. We've had sit downs with the players daily. We have two players that come and speak in mixed zones. But I was able to get a one-on-one sit down with Pochettino, and a week later he did a small roundtable with reporters. When FIFA takes over, it's a little bit different. Today's match day minus one, so it's a FIFA run event. So we get a mix zone with three different players, and then a press conference later today with Mauricio Pochettino, the coach. So I would say they have this down to an art. And even in the post game, they've improved now, where you get two players immediately after the game ends in the mix zone, but they're kind of like on a podium. So it's not quite press conference style. It's not quite mix zone, but you do get some immediate quotes. And then later the players come through, the full teams come through, and every player must pass through the mix zone. Now, whether they stop or not, that'll vary from team to team and how aggressive the press officers are. But I would say overall, people are pretty happy with the access, which isn't always the case at big events.
So for those who've never been in a mix zone who are listening to this, basically the athletes sort of come through, fair to say, like sort of like a maze-like kind of structure, and they have the option to talk or not. But in my experiences doing mix zone, Paul, at the Olympics, it could be a bit of a shit show. Like, it really depends on sort of where you are situated when the athlete comes through. So I don't know how many people are covering the United States national team. I assume it's a ton. Like, can you get is there any kind of functionality when these players come through where can you actually get anything, I guess, from that setup?
Yeah, you can. I mean, look, one of my favorite taglines ever on anyone's Twitter bio was Steve Goff, a longtime Washington Post writer, now with Yahoo, who wrote on his Twitter bio that he was a mixed zone warrior. And that's kind of what you have to be. Elbows out, get a good position. There is a bit of a benefit, frankly, to being a longtime beat guy on the U.S. national team, in that we kind of clump together and get to a certain spot, and the press officer makes sure that players stop in front of us, and the players recognize a lot of us and we'll stop there as well. And then there's different outlets that do it differently. We at The Athletic have a bit of an advantage in that we have three people here covering the U.S. So we only need one person in that clump of the reporters, and the other two of us are trying to, or usually actually only two of the three get mix zone. So the two of us in the mix zone, we split duties. And so sometimes you try to spin off and you see if you can get somebody that no one's really talking to towards the end of the mix zone. Can you, do you have a relationship where they'll actually stop for you? And it's hit or miss. Like, for the most part, the U.S. players know me and have seen me, and they'll stop for me, even if they are so close to getting out. And they're like, man, there's a risk. If I stop here, I'm stopped for a while. But the other day, there was a player who blew right by me, like just wouldn't even acknowledge me. And that's part of the mix zone, too. So, yeah, you definitely have to have a strategy. When I cover Argentina, for example, I know now the two or three reporters that Messi knows, respects, or has a relationship with, and where he'll stop. So I usually set myself up right behind that reporter on the front end of the mix zone. And then as soon as Messi's done, I spin off to look for the second reporter. And then I spin off to look for the third reporter so that I can get him at all three stops and hear everything he has to say. So you have to be able to strategize that way in a mix zone.
That's pretty fascinating. So I want to ask a couple questions off that. First, on the U.S. team, who do you consider the best talker, or who are some of the players who like to talk?
There are actually a decent number of good. I would say Tim Ream is the best talker in terms of his ability to see the big picture, understand what the questions are, have an understanding of like what he wants to say and to say it confidently. Weston McKennie, when Weston stops, is wonderful. He's gregarious. He's outgoing. He's funny. He's good natured. He can hold court for a long time, but he's also very informative. He also has really good insight, which, you know, those don't always go together. And you can get that. Sometimes you can get like really sharp insight from certain guys who maybe are quieter at other moments. So Tim Weah, I think Tim Weah is very good at kind of, especially if it's about his own performance, reflecting on what just happened and kind of giving you a different idea of what a player might be thinking or going through. Serginho Dest is not always seen. He's funny and he's good natured. You wouldn't necessarily think he's great in like press conferences, but when you get him in a mix zone, it's a little bit more intimate and he actually is quite good. And so there's a lot of guys like that I think come through pretty regularly for the press corps.
Interesting. So when it gets to the greatest players in the world, you mentioned Messi, the Mbappes, you know, Ronaldo's, et cetera. Do they actually talk during the mix zone? It's my thought would be, and obviously I don't know, is that maybe when you get to a certain level of stardom, like it's not really going to benefit you per se to stop and talk to the world's press, but I've never covered the World Cup. So what's that scenario like?
Yeah, I think it's really been aided by these pods where the player of the match gets brought right afterwards in the same way that they do the flash interviews with the rights holders. And so the bigger name players are typically the man of the match a lot of times, Mbappe or Dembele or whoever. And so when they're in this setting where they know I have 4 minutes here, there's going to be five questions, and they're much better at that. It can be a little bit more hit or miss. And it depends on, I think, the player's mentality. Like Messi didn't always love stopping in the mix zone, but he is the captain of the national team now. And he feels a really big responsibility, not just to the media that's there, not really to the media that's there, but to the fans, because they've been so incredible at showing up for Argentina in Qatar and again here in the United States. And so you can see that he feels an obligation to stop and talk and to be a leader for the national team. And I've been very impressed, frankly, with the fact that he does multiple stops in the mix zone. But it's not always that way. Like Alphonso Davies stopped the other day, took three questions and was gone in 56 seconds.
Yeah, I saw
so that. It's you know, it really is up to the personality of the player and sometimes the mood and how the game has gone. But there are, you know, you will see the big name players stop. And the question is, are you lucky enough to be at the front of the metal barrier that you can actually get your recorder close enough to hear what they're saying?
Where are you sitting in these stadiums? It's always interesting because in some, let's take baseball, for example, some baseball stadiums where the press is still behind home plate, you know, very traditional, like best seat in the house. And then I can tell you, like at Rogers Center in Toronto, press is now in the left field. Yeah, you know, it's sort of like it's on a side. NFL traditionally great sight lines. You know, you get to see everything. Where are they putting the press for the World Cup?
Yeah, we're in the NFL press boxes so far. I hate it because unlike the rest of the world, NFL press boxes are behind glass.
Yeah,
so you lose the atmosphere, which is. Anywhere else you watch soccer in the world, it's open air press boxes, so you can understand the vibe of the stadium. So really what I do, what I've done every game of this World Cup that I've covered, is I go outside for the first 20 minutes and I watch from the concourse. I found a nice spot that I'm not going to share in SoFi because I do need to go back in the quarterfinals. That is like a perfect place to watch. I'm standing next to the police officers. And that way I can get the anthems and I can get the first 20 minutes. I get the feel for the stadium in Seattle. My little brother flew in. So I went up and found where my brother John was standing for the anthem and stood next to him which was really a cool experience for me to have like a family moment. And then I just went down the stands to like a place where I wouldn't get kicked out to watch the first 20 minutes of that game. So I think that's really important. But otherwise, we're in the NFL press boxes. And so the sight lines are fine. It's just that you lose a little bit of that. Some of it gets piped in, but even then, it's a little bit more sterile than it would be. Whereas in Qatar, we're sitting in the tribunes, is what they call them, which are just like parts of the stands that have been sectioned off, and they've made like makeshift desks. And the tribunes are still here, but they're used mostly for the broadcast rights holders and not the print schlubs.
What cities have you been in where you've covered games?
Los Angeles and Seattle so far. The U.S. is all West Coast, and I went and covered Canada the other night, which was also in L.A. I'll go back to – I'm here in Bay Area tomorrow, then if the U.S. wins, back to Seattle. If the U.S. – whenever the U.S. goes out, I'll bounce around a little bit more and get – but I would note, like, talking to my colleague Felipe Cardenas and my former colleague and friend Pablo Maurer, who have been to a lot more stadiums, when you're at the Azteca in Mexico – which I've covered in a qualifier, they're outside. They're right in the mix of it. You know, Felipe got beer spilled on him after both. But like, that's part of it. That's what you want.
Experience.
Yeah. You want that. You want to feel one of the most incredible atmospheres I've ever covered a game in was USA, Iran in Qatar, because the tension on every level was so high. And within the stadium, there were these political connotations, and you're right in the middle of the crowd. You're watching everyone's nerves build over the course of the game. No chance I would have been able to feel that if I were behind the glass in a press box.
Roughly speaking, what time, when are you at the game? 4 hours, 5 hours in advance? Like, what's, because you got to, I mean, there's a traffic situation there, right? And you want to make sure you get in. So when are you there?
Yeah, man, for the World Cup, I don't mess around. You know, like usually you go 2 hours before a game for a normal U.S. game. For the World Cup, I'm there the moment they open their doors. So I try to get to the stadium like 4 hours ahead of time, 3.5, 4 hours. And then they open the doors for press like 3 hours before kickoff. So that gives some time to walk the parking lots, get a feel for where the fans are coming from. You know, Seattle is so different. It's so wonderful right in the heart of downtown. And so you could walk around all the coffee shops and the bars and see everything, but just make sure you're there. Make sure, and like, I'm already, you know, alarms are raised that they could have either the vice president or the president at the round of 16 in Seattle, is what the buzz is on social media. Hmm. And so in those cases, I'm going to get down there even earlier than that, because I just, you know, you don't know what you're in for.
I want to get to the U.S. in a second, but prior to that, from your experience covering the Canadian team in terms of as a media person, are there differences in terms of how the Canadian, I guess it's Canada Soccer, how Canada Soccer approaches media coverage versus USA Soccer?
No, I don't think there's differences in how they approach it. They have a smaller press corps, and that is a good thing, in that the relationships between Canada Soccer and the people who regularly cover the team, they're quite good. And that allows access to be a little bit better in some moments, and to have conversations about what kinds of stories, you know, if you have a problem, it's easier to have those kind of talks. I think it's interesting. Every little beat has its kind of hierarchy within the beat, and who's asking the questions and who has the relationships. And then you have the different dynamics, like a player like Alphonso Davies and kind of his relationship with the press corps. So all of that, it's different than the U.S., but I think in general, Canada Soccer has improved and improved and improved as the stature of the team has gone up, in understanding the role of the media, kind of finding ways to embrace it. And I think some of the best coverage that we at The Athletic have done over the course of this tournament has been what Josh Cloak has been doing with Canada, because, well, one, Josh Cloaker is so, call him Cloaker. He'd be mad at me if you heard me call him Josh. So I'm going to call him Cloaker here. You know, the work Cloaker has been doing has been so wonderful, but part of it is down. You have to give credit to Canada Soccer as well for allowing a reporter to get those moments and that type of access. Like he did a behind the scenes piece with the medical staff. That's a great idea. It only happens with Canada Soccer helping out.
All right, let's get to the U.S. You know, obviously a massive opportunity. They play Bosnia-Herzegovina in their first game, and then I think everybody sort of is familiar with what the future games would hold in terms of potential opponents, and if form held, it's going to be a rough go once you get to like the round of eight. Having seen them, having covered them, what is realistic for this team, given what you've seen so far in the tournament and what opponents they have coming up?
Well, they should win on Wednesday night against Bosnia and Herzegovina. Like that's a should win game. And I think they are a little bit protected against a letdown mentally or emotionally overlooking in two ways. One, they are the fourth day of knockouts, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. Yeah, fourth day of knockouts. So they've been able to see Paraguay take out Germany, right? They've been able to see some of these upsets that say, hey, don't take anybody for granted, because even a big team like Germany can go down in a knockout one-off game. But the second thing is the crowds have been phenomenal. And the team is very clearly feeding off of the energy of these home crowds, as would be expected. And so I think that'll really help in all of these games, but I think it should help protect against kind of a trap game with Bosnia. That being said, I think if you lose this round of 32 game, this tournament's a complete failure. I think if you lose the round of 16 game to, let's say, Belgium, it's a disappointment, but it's not a failure. I think the hope of like starting to actually allow this World Cup to be something different or special or something that could be more lasting means that you're going to a quarterfinal, you're coming back to Los Angeles, and you're playing probably Spain in a World Cup quarterfinal on home soil. Like that game would have the potential to be by far the most watched U.S. men's national team game ever. And it's a knockout game. Like anything can happen. You can go punch for punch at home with Spain. You start to change the way people talk about men's soccer in the United States. So what could they do? I definitely think they're capable of getting to that quarterfinal round. I would not sit on any podcast and predict them to beat Spain, but I think they could absolutely get to that quarterfinal round. And I hope that they, my hope is that they perform up to that potential, because, you know, we are in this weird position as soccer reporters. Like my livelihood in some ways is you're constantly fighting for, you know, people to pay attention and saying it's worthwhile and soccer matters and it's making progress in this country. And like, in a way, you're in certain moments, you're almost advocating for the sport, and it would make everyone's lives and jobs easier in soccer in America if this team were to live up to the expectation. But there's a lot between that. There's two big games between that, that team in a quarterfinal right now.
Do you think if they lost they beat Bosnia and then they lose in the next round, would you consider that a successful tournament for them?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think it would be a normal tournament, and normal shouldn't be considered successful because you're at home, right? You're at home and you have this golden generation that everyone's been talking about since the failure in Cuba, Trinidad in 2017, that this next generation of player was different and better. They go to Europe earlier. They play at bigger clubs. They're better than any American team before them without having done anything to deserve that praise, right? Like, and everything, they were the second youngest team in the World Cup in Qatar, the youngest starting lineup. But all of the progress, quote unquote, there in Qatar was we wrote about that team and thought about that team in the context of 4 years later, they'll be in their prime, they'll be at home. That's when you'll see it happen. So if they get to the same exact round that they got to in Qatar, that's a disappointment. It just is. And so I think at this point, the players are probably going to start feeling a little bit of that pressure of understanding the moment to prove yourself is here now.
How much, and maybe you just can't see much of it, do you see much of the television coverage at all?
Not much. You know, I was actually telling my colleagues last night here at the hotel, we ended up watching the game at the hotel bar and they kept it on. And it was the first time I had seen like the late night James Corden show.
Right.
I went to bed after a few minutes of it. I'd had enough, but like, so here and there, I watch a lot of Telemundo. So I miss out on a whole bunch of what's happening on Fox. But even if I'm not watching it in the same way people are at home, I don't miss what's being said. I am being alerted to everything. The company has multiple people that are watching it. My bosses are watching it. The things that are being said are being put into our Slack channels. And, you know, I'm certainly not blind to like the Alexis, Latan, Thierry dynamics. But yeah, I watch it a little bit differently, I would say, than the viewer at home.
Yeah, no, I totally understood. So far, whether in person or on highlights or television, what is the best team that you've seen so far and why?
France. I mean, they're just incredible. The amount of attacking talent on that team is insane. The players that they have coming off the bench, you know, when you have someone like Desiree Doué, who's the fourth name I would mention in the attack, it's just speaks to the quality that they have. And you know, Olise is my favorite player in the world right now. And then you've got Mbappe and you've got Dembele. And I look at that team and I think, who has the quality, the athleticism, the mentality, the competitiveness to go punch for punch with a team like France? And I thought one of them was the Netherlands, and now they're headed home. So yeah, for me, I picked them before the tournament. I've seen nothing to change my mind. France is the best team here, and it'll be a matter of whether, you know, another team, whether they get unlucky, or, you know, there are teams that are capable in like a final of goal. We've seen it with Argentina, which is a team that it's a quality team in a different way. The kind of closeness of that group, but from quality standpoint, whew, France is the top.
All right, a couple more here. You mentioned that you had a chance to cover Canada, and you've written about Jesse Marsh, and recently just wrote about Jesse Marsh for The Athletic. I can tell you, living in Toronto now, and I, you know, and like Jesse Marsh, American Canadian, it's interesting. He has, whether it's performative or not, he has figured out a way, or he figured out the way, I should say, to get the Canadian public to embrace him. And one of the things he was really smart about is twofold. One, he demanded success, right? And doesn't sort of look at Canada as some kind of like lower tier country. It's like, you know, we belong here, we can play well. That's big, obviously. And obviously they have a very good generation. The other thing though, is he was very smart to lean into politics, in my opinion, and be like, this 51st state stuff is bullshit. And like, the president of the United States shouldn't say this. And I'm insulted like by this kind of stuff. That really played well with the Canadian public. And I think actually is the moment where they really embraced this guy. Obviously, it helps a lot that they just beat South Africa and they're further along than they've ever been. But Marsh is an interesting guy. I find him to be an interesting guy because he's not your typical Canadian national team coach of a, you know, of a team, mostly because he wasn't born here. And so I wonder, from your perspective, you got a little chance, obviously, to cover him in the tournament, but you also know him from his, you know, connection with the U.S. national team. What's your thought on Marsh, just broadly?
Yeah, I mean, I probably have written more about Jesse than anyone out there, frankly. Yeah. I went to Salzburg to watch him play and to coach his first Champions League game.
Yeah, Red Bull.
And then, you know, had enough from my notebook when he took the job at Leipzig to go dive back in and talk to him a little bit more. And then during the Copa America, I wrote about him going to the semifinal and called his wife Kim and talked to her. So I've written a lot about Jesse, and I feel like I know him pretty well. And that's not even going into the MLS days. Yeah, Jesse, I'll say this about Jesse, man. Like, he is who he is, and he's always been that way. And so whether you like him or not, whether you think he's brash or cocky or, you know, a loudmouth or loves to be the center of attention, you know, all of which are true to varying degrees, that is who he is. And I also like that Jesse doesn't apologize for it, and he doesn't try to pretend he's something different.
Right.
Which a lot of people do. A lot of people will say they don't have an ego or they're not whatever. And they, all of the coaches are, by the way, all of them. And I'm not surprised that he was able to endear himself to the Canadian people right away. I think I knew that his personality would fit really well with this group, and I knew that the coaching style would fit really well with this team. And Jesse's very smart, and I think he understood very quickly the political side of things and when speaking out is important, which, by the way, is also brave. Like, it's very easy to avoid those questions and to take that stage, even if you love big stages. That one holds different implications. And so, you know, the fact that Jesse was willing to come out and challenge the president of the United States at a time when doing that can open you up to loads of abuse, I really respected that he had his stand and he took it. And I also think that, to your point on like, he's very different than Canadian coaches, like, and I wrote this in the column the other day, like, that is what Canada soccer needs right now. They need a salesman. They need somebody that says, pay attention to us, believe in us. We're doing something that you can cheer for, you know, get behind us the way you get behind Canada hockey, get behind us the way you get behind your favorite NHL team or your even the Major League Baseball and NBA teams. Like, hop on board. You're not going to be disappointed. And they had a personality that was kind of a variant of that in John Herdman before, but he didn't have the stature and the resume that Jesse did coming from European jobs. And that matters too, because the Canadian public is able to say, who is this guy? Oh, he's an American. I'm not. Oh, he coached in Europe. Oh, okay. Like he coached in England. All right. I'll pay attention to what this guy has to say. And so I think he's been a perfect fit for Canada soccer in a lot of ways. And I do think that Jesse is good at what he does as well. Like in these types of settings, I do think Jesse can still be the right coach for Canada in the next cycle after this one. And not every coach is made for that second cycle, but I think kind of the way he has this team playing and the players that Canada has coming through on every level, it's a good fit.
Yeah, no, I hope he's around. That Germany job may be open. So I guess we'll see what happens.
I don't think he's going to be going to Germany anytime soon. It didn't go well enough at Leipzig for that.
No, I hear you. All right. One last thing about, and again, like in some ways, we're not going to know until the end of the tournament. And Abby, you mentioned this, and I think you're dead on this. If the United States gets to the round of eight, like, you have no idea what that could mean for soccer in this country. But, you know, you are someone who's written about MLS for a long, for a long, long time. And actually, I think just even as we're taping this over the last day or so, Robert Lewandowski is now with Chicago, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's interesting. Polish, obviously great Polish striker and, you know, played for some great clubs in the world. Do you have any thoughts at this time? And maybe, again, we just have to wait until where the U.S. goes, like what this World Cup will mean for MLS. I look at this, obviously, and I've written a lot about this from the sports media perspective. So I'll tell you mine and you can sort of riff off this. I do think this World Cup will bring some new viewers to soccer writ large, but I don't think the revolution happens because of this World Cup. I think that league is what it is. And I think to expect like waves of college football fans, right, or NHL fans to start watching MLS, I just think is sort of naive and not the way the world has worked here. But if you can incrementally get more people and get more people excited, that's how you grow the league. And I think that's a real possibility. But at the same time, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this is the World Cup where it game changes things for the U.S. domestic league. How do you see it? Again, understanding that you are someone in the middle of this and in some ways, you know, have a vested interest in the sport. And so you have certainly a unique perspective.
Yeah. Well, I've just written a book about this, essentially. It's called The Messi Effect. And it really is about the effect part of Messi coming to America. But this book is more than just Messi. It goes into the idea of what you're talking about with the World Cup and what comes next, where American soccer is, when Messi arrived and what got it there, which more than anything was the Premier League deal with NBC in 2014, which mainstreamed the sport in a way it hadn't before. Champions League coverage becoming a global sensation, the American Champions League coverage through social media, TikTok and Instagram, that people all over the world watch the American version of Champions League coverage, albeit without Americans on the desk, but I still think it doesn't matter. It's reaching the newer generations where they need to be reached. We've seen the mainstreaming via Ted Lasso and Welcome to Wrexham that have sold the romance of the sport. All of these things are contributing. And then, of course, we have to acknowledge Liga MX is the most watched soccer league in this country. So there are all these audiences that are tuning in to soccer in all these different places. And MLS has fallen further and further behind. They had a head start and they lost it when the Premier League signed that NBC deal. And they've been they haven't been scrambling. They've been slow playing it while everyone passed them. And Messi gave them a second chance to get things done right or fix things and get things done in time for the World Cup. And they still did not get the changes that they need to get changed done in time for the World Cup. And that is hugely disappointing, and it's a huge missed opportunity for MLS. But I agree with you that it doesn't mean it's completely lost. The league has time to recover. It has time to grow. It has to get some really big decisions right. And that's kind of what the second half of my book is about, is the discussions that have been happening at the board level in Major League Soccer about how to push this league forward to capture these fans who have come in for Messi, who are going to come in for the World Cup. And the answer is, yes, you can go do what they're doing right now, which is what the rules allow. Robert Lewandowski and Casemiro's coming, and Messi's there, and Son and at LAFC, Thomas Muller in Vancouver, Antoine Griezmann in Orlando. That happened in 2015 when I was covering Orlando City in Orlando. Kaká came, and Frank Lampard and Andrea Pirlo and David Villa and Zlatan came the next year, and Steven Gerrard. MLS has always done this. So what needs to change? The quality of the product has to get better. If you want people, this the business strategy of MLS has to shift from being a very good local product that puts butts in seats into one that compels people to watch on television. Because what makes all sports leagues go? Media rights. And they're not paying you any money if no one's watching. And so we have now, there's always been this chicken or egg conversation of what comes first, the quality on the field or the TV deal. You got the owners have seen, we have enough evidence. Put a better product on the field and give yourself a shot at people watching. And MLS, they've changed the calendar. They're flipping the calendar, which is a necessary move. They're changing the structure of the regular season to try to have more compelling games for longer, which is important. But the biggest change is changing the roster rules so you can increase the overall product on the field, not just the stars. It has to go both. You do need the stars, but you need the product to be better to get people to watch. And they haven't completed that part of it. It's linked to the CBA negotiations. I acknowledge that, which comes up in January 31st of 2028. But they and the union need to wake up to the fact that everyone, it's in their best interest to get this deal done in the summer of 27, to make these changes all together, flip the calendar, have new roster rules, go have all the owners going out and spending a lot of money to make the product better and sell the new MLS and give yourself a chance, because everyone else that's here already is coming for more. You think FIFA's not going to come back after as much money as they made on this tournament? They're coming back. The Copa America's coming back. Club World Cup's coming back. The Premier League's still coming for more. Relevant is still coming for more. If Liga MX gets that deal done with Apollo and they consolidate their media rights for the first time ever, and they're the most watched league in this country, what do you think that media deal is going to look like? And now you're chasing Liga MX to be the biggest league in this hemisphere. Don't let them get there first. So all of that factors in. It's not just the World Cup, but it is ultimately contingent on Don Garber and the owners making the right decision and making it in time for it to make an impact.
It's really well said, and I'm glad you mentioned your book, The Messi Effect, How the Global Legend Changed the Future of American Soccer. That book debuted June 2nd, 2026, St. Martin's Press. So just head to Amazon or wherever you get your, or your local bookstore, if you're old school like that, wherever you get your books, it'll be there. All right, lastly, will you be at the final? Is there like a gigantic athletic contingent? So you're one of them, right?
There is. I've been told I'll be at the final. So hopefully that's what happens. I was very declarative there. I think it's important to have an American voice in the press box for a World Cup final in the United States. And, you know, I'm going, it'll be my first World Cup final, actually. I came home from Qatar early. But for me, it's important to tell that story, whoever's playing in that game, from the perspective of some of what we just talked about. What does this moment mean in the United States for the future of the sport? And so I hope to be able to tell that story for a really wide audience. And I also want to shout out to The Athletic, but so many of my stories have also gone in the print edition of the New York Times. I feel very fortunate about that. And it's a reminder to me to be writing for the wider audience that's being introduced to this game and try to make sure I'm balancing that to the diehards who have followed me for a long time. But to reach as many people as we can with this tournament.
Yeah, no, for journalists, I mean, that print, getting place in the Times still matters. Even in 2026, have you hit A1 because you are covering a global event right now?
They haven't sent me an A1 yet. I'm holding out hope. But, you know, Tariq is out there. They've got.
They do. They have their old school guys as well. In addition to the ability to put The Athletic stories on there.
Yeah, they've got a lot of talented writers. One of my best friends who stood at my wedding, James Wagner, is a very talented writer for them, based out of Mexico City. Yeah. So you know, I hope it would be awesome, like covering the final, maybe have a shot at something like that. Yeah, you're right. It means a lot to me, and I hadn't seen my name in print since I left the Sentinel. I had gone kind of all digital. And so the first time I was in the New York Times print edition was a really cool feeling. So hoping for more.
Yeah. Congrats to James Wagner escaping the Mets and heading to Mexico City.
Yeah, exactly.
He's incredibly enough, he's won on that deal. Who would have guessed? Paul Tenorio is a senior writer for The Athletic, who covers soccer. Check out his work all month on The Athletic. He's covering the World Cup, and obviously we'll follow the U.S. national team for as long as it can go, and we'll see how long that team can go. They have looked very, very good. And even the result, Paraguay beating Germany in penalties, I think makes maybe the U.S. one look even better, because they looked pretty good against your traditional European power. Paul, travel safe, and enjoy the rest of the tournament. It has been a great tournament to watch, and so far, knock on wood, just an incredibly successful soccer experiment in the United States and Mexico and in Canada. We'll be reading. Thanks so much for joining me today on the Sports Media Podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a real joy to have this conversation. I've been listening to your pod for a long time, so it's nice to be on it.
Nice for you to say. Thank you. All right, back in the studio. My thanks to Paul Todorio for coming on. Very, very clutch of him to do this, because I reached out in a very, very busy time for him, and he was very cool to agree to make some time between a couple of press conferences. Check out his book, obviously. Very, very few people in the country have a better feel for the American soccer experience than Paul does. If you like this kind of stuff, head to the archives. We have done a massive amount of roundtables over the last couple of weeks. The last one, Linda Cohn leaves ESPN. We did talk about World Cup coverage on Fox, and then obviously the New York Times story on Diana Rossini. Stan Van Gundy was on this podcast on June 23rd. Talking about a lot of different things. Monica McNutt and Mike Breen on this podcast June 18th, talking about what it was like to cover the Knicks and their championship run. And then you could obviously head to the archives. Al Michaels was on this podcast in May. I'm trying to do this off the top of my head. Ian Eagle was on it in May as well. Anyway, we trying to keep the calendar, so a lot of basketball stuff. And now we have worked on So again, if you like the podcast, leave us a review and a note. That's how the podcast continues. I want to thank James Jackson for all his hard work. Thanks to everybody at Odyssey for their support. And thank you for listening. We'll see you soon on the Sports Media Podcast.